content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the April 22, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I'll read articles about new conspiracy theories in the U.S. and another about evangelicals and gun control in the U.S. Well, given that it's Easter week, I'll begin with an article, a short article from the archives from the April 6, 2012 edition of the New Yorker, an article entitled How Muslims View Easter by Rollo Romig. Jesus didn't die on the cross. He was born of a virgin, but he isn't the Son of God. He did not redeem the sins of humankind. He healed the sick, gave sight to the blind, and raised the dead. He spoke complete sentences even as an infant in the cradle, announcing to his mother Mary that God had granted him the scripture and made him a prophet. Jesus is neither almighty nor eternal. Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is a Muslim. This is the Jesus of the Quran. 93 of its verses refer to him, more than any other prophet save Muhammad. And the Quranic account of Jesus' life harmonizes with the Gospels in more particulars than even many Muslims realize. My wife is a Muslim with years of madrasa education behind her, but when I mentioned Jesus' virgin birth to her, she was skeptical. "Does the Quran really say that?" she asked. I started to look it up, but 5 seconds later she waved me off. "Don't bother, I found it on Wikipedia." And so it was written. With Easter on the way, I became curious about what the Quran has to say about the crucifixion. I called an imam I know, Ibrahim Sahar, and we got together over glasses of Turkish tea. Sayar does a lot of interfaith work, much of which involves getting people from different religions together to eat kebabs. In the company of Christians, he said, mentioning the status of Jesus in Islam can be a great icebreaker. I always tell people there are millions of Muslims named after Jesus and Mary. We called them Isa and Maryam, he said. Nobody names their children after someone they don't like. In Islam, he emphasized, believing in Jesus is an absolute requirement. If you don't believe in him, you're automatically not a Muslim. According to the Hadith, sayings of the Prophet, second only to the Quran in Islamic authority, Jesus was assumed into heaven and will return at the end of time in the east of Damascus, his hands resting on the shoulders of two angels. When it sees him, the Antichrist will dissolve like salt in water, and Jesus will rule the earth for 40 years. What Muslims don't believe, though, is that Jesus died on the cross. It's spelled out quite clearly, Sayar said, in the Quran's fourth surah, verse 157, quote, "They did not kill him, nor did they crucify him," end quote. The Bible is considered a holy book in Islam. How then, I ask, can this verse in the Quran be reconciled with the accounts of Jesus' death in the Gospels? Sayar said that the key is in the phrase that follows, quote, "Nor did they crucify him," end quote. Quote, "though it was made to look like that to them," end quote. Muslim scholars, he explained, interpret this passage in a range of ways. Some believe that someone was, in fact, crucified, but it was not Jesus. Maybe it was Judas. Whoever it was, they say God changed his face to resemble Jesus, and Jesus himself was spared. A slight variation posits that God changed the vision of all those who witnessed the crucifixion to make them think they were seeing Jesus. Others argue that it was Jesus who was nailed to the cross, but that he survived it. What happened on Easter Sunday was not a resurrection, but a resuscitation. Some say that no one was crucified at all. Of course, Sayar said, they all have their own proofs. For Muslims, the specifics of the crucifixion are largely academic. The disagreement between Christians and Muslims on the nature of Jesus, though, is fundamental, no matter how many ways their understanding of him may correspond. To Muslims, Jesus is not and could not possibly be divine. He is a prophet, but he's still immortal, and God is not his father. I understand that if you believe someone to be God and others say he's not God, it's like an insult, Sayar said. But if you look at it from the Muslim perspective, there's no difference between Jesus and Abraham and Muhammad. The Quran mentions 25 prophets, and nearly all of them are familiar from the Bible. Adam and Noah, Moses and Abraham, David and Solomon, Lot and Job, John the Baptist. They're all messengers, Sayar said. But to Christians, the message of Jesus is inseparable from his crucifixion and resurrection. When Muslims and Christians meet, Sayar said, the Jesus connection can only take them so far. Getting into a deep conversation about exactly what happened to Jesus in the Gospels versus the Jesus in the Quran only ends up emphasizing the gulf. We try to learn from each other as we are, Sayar said. We are not doing this for the afterlife. We are doing it for this life. In the afterlife, we'll see anyway who is wrong, who is right, what is Jesus. We will learn everything there. Until that time comes, it might be best to focus on the kebabs. And now an article by Eliza Griswold entitled God, Guns, and Country, The Evangelical Fight Over Firearms. On the afternoon of Good Friday in April 2010, Shane Claiborne, a 35-year-old evangelical activist sporting dreadlocks and homemade pants, followed a group of teenagers carrying an 8-foot-tall wooden cross down a street in North Philadelphia. They marched to a gun store in Kensington called the Shooter Shop, which was notorious for allowing straw buyers to purchase guns illegally. Philadelphia has been hit hard by the heroin epidemic and its associated gun violence. In 2010, some 250 people were killed with guns in the city, and more than 1,000 people have been killed in the last 4 years, far more than in Los Angeles, though it has a much larger population. Claiborne, along with hundreds of members of Heeding God's Call to End Gun Violence, a faith-based group that advocates for gun reform, was going to hold a vigil outside the shop to convince its owners to adopt a 10-point code of conduct to render the store more accountable for the weapons it sold. When the protesters arrived, they found a group of counter-protesters lining the sidewalk and waving American flags. Claiborne led a recitation of the Lord's Prayer while the counter-protesters loudly chanted the words to God Bless America. Then Claiborne told the crowd about a night, a month earlier, when he'd heard gunfire coming from outside his home and ran out the door to find a young man named Pepito bleeding in the street. Claiborne held Pepito's hand until an ambulance arrived, but he died later that day. At the end of the rally, a woman approached Claiborne and told him that she was Pepito's mother. I understand something I hadn't understood before, he recalled her saying. God knows what it feels like to lose a son. Claiborne refers to himself as a holy troublemaker, and over the past decade he has become something of a celebrity in Christian circles for challenging believers to scrutinize the difference between the Bible's teachings and those espoused in conservative American culture. His first book, The Irresistible Revolution, about finding his calling in social justice work, sold more than 300,000 copies. As I crisscross the country, I can feel a new momentum and movement, Jim Wallace, the editor of Sojourners magazine, wrote in the foreword. The monologue of the religious right is finally over, and a fresh dialogue has begun. Claiborne grew up in a conservative Christian household in East Tennessee. In 1993, he moved to Philadelphia to attend a Christian college and was shocked by the poverty and homelessness he saw in the city. He became involved with student activism and in 1995 occupied an abandoned church where homeless families were squatting in order to help keep the church from being knocked down and the families from being displaced. In March 2003, he traveled to Iraq to protest the American bombing campaign and was injured in a car accident during the visit. He has written, quote, "It's difficult to know where Christianity ends and America begins," end quote. Claiborne believes that conservative culture often conflates Christianity and nationalism, placing, as he puts it, quote, "the American flag above the cross," end quote. This has long involved aligning religion with American gun culture. Last year, Wayne LaPierre, the executive vice president of the National Rifle Association, said in a speech that the Second Amendment was not a right bestowed by man, but granted by God to all Americans as our American birthright. In 2017, after a shooting at a Southern Baptist church near San Antonio, Texas, left 26 people dead and 20 injured, some Christian leaders called for members of their church to arm themselves. Robertson Jeffress, the pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, said on Fox and Friends that he felt more secure knowing that his congregants were carrying weapons. After the shooting in San Bernardino, California in 2015, Jerry Falwell, Jr., the president of Liberty University, urged his students to procure gun permits. Along with a year-round ski facility, Liberty's campus is home to a sprawling firing range. "I've always thought that if more good people had concealed carry permits, then we could end those Muslims before they walked in," he told students. Claiborne said, "The irony is you can't have a beer at Liberty, but you can have a gun." Some pro-gun Christians argue that Scripture supports their claims. Many rely on a passage from the book of Luke in which Jesus says, quote, "Let the one who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one," end quote. This, they argue, is proof that Jesus believed in the use of deadly force. Some folks would say he was calling on his followers to arm themselves, but that's definitely misused, Claiborne told me. He is part of a movement of millennial evangelicals who are trying to separate their faith from the Republican politics of their elders. Claiborne, along with the members of Heeding God's Call and Live Free campaign, which tries to convince congregations to support gun control, believes that living as Jesus did requires renouncing violence. He often quotes a passage from the book of Matthew in which Peter, attempting to defend Jesus against the Romans, pulls out a sword and lops off the ear of a Roman servant. Jesus rebukes him, saying, "For all they who take the sword will perish by the sword." On a recent afternoon, Claiborne, who had cut off his dreads and now wears glasses that frame eyes perpetually widened in glee, took me on a walk to the shooter shop. Kensington is an impoverished neighborhood, but Claiborne has been trying to help the community. On our walk, we passed an aquaponic greenhouse that Claiborne had built with the help of a drummer who'd toured with 9-inch nails, and an empty lot where construction vehicles were digging the foundation for a recreation center that Claiborne had convinced the city to let a local nonprofit build. We passed under an L station and arrived at the store, which was now shuttered. "Now homeless veterans are living up there," Claiborne said, pointing to the apartments above the storefront. Soon after the vigil at the shop, Claiborne had decided to take on the issue of guns full-time. In March, with his friend Michael Martin, a bearded Mennonite and amateur blacksmith, Claiborne published a book called Beating Guns, which discusses the role that white evangelicals play in promoting gun culture. 41% of white evangelicals have guns, he told me. The same people who worship the Prince of Peace are packing heat. Claiborne was planning to drive across the country along with his wife, Katie Jo, and Martin in a decommissioned school bus that Katie Jo has refitted into a tiny home with saffron curtains, a composting toilet, and solar panels. They hold vigils in places riven by mass shootings or drug-related violence, during which they would collect guns and melt them down in a mobile forge. They would invite survivors to help beat the molten metal into hoes and spades, an enactment of a passage from the book of Isaiah, which advises believers to beat their swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. The afternoon before Claiborne left for the trip, I visited him at the pale yellow row house in Kensington where he lives. Outside his home is a large mural, a Banksy replica of two children standing atop a mountain of defunct weapons. Inside, a purple tandem bike hangs from the ceiling near a painting of Mother Teresa. Katie Jo, who is 36, with a blonde braid down her back, had lain awake for the past few nights trying to account for every square inch of the bus. Claiborne and Martin were now loading it under her watchful eye, shuttling backpacks and boxes from the house out to the porch. At one point, Claiborne disappeared into the basement to fetch some wooden signs that he had made by cutting up old gun advertisements and fashioning them into inspirational words like hope, faith, and love. He returned with a large stack, and Katie Jo glanced at him with the patience of one accustomed to trying to speak in practical terms to a self-styled visionary. "Oh, no, is all that coming?" she asked. "It ain't gonna fit on the bus." Claiborne moved to Kensington in 1998 and started The Simple Way, a Christian community service organization that runs a food bank, which distributes 4 tons of food each week. He was living as a celibate man for religious reasons when, a few years later, he met Katie Jo, a teacher who had moved to Philadelphia on a 1-year mission program. Neither liked the term missionary. "It's more of a short-term drive-by thing," Claiborne told me. Katie Jo said, "Our mission isn't to make people Christians. Our mission is to love people. And if they love Jesus, great." Kensington, even more than the rest of Philadelphia, has been devastated by the opioid crisis. 6 or 7 times I've come home to find people dying on our doorstep, Katie Jo told me. When she called 911 for help, the first responders often assumed that she was an addict, too. They always ask, "What are you on?" she said. Outsiders often dismiss Kensington as zombie land because of the number of addicts who live there. "That's what people thought about Nazareth," Claiborne said. He quoted a passage from the Gospel of John when a skeptical man asked one of Jesus' disciples, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" The disciple replies, "Come and see." In recent months, following a major drug bust several blocks away, both the use of heroin and the tempo of shootings in the neighborhood had decreased. "We thought it might have something to do with our presence," Katie Jo told me, with a self-aware smile. "But then we found out they aren't putting fentanyl in the heroin, so it's not as strong and people aren't buying as much." In the past few weeks, new dealers had come into the neighborhood to hand out free samples across the street from the Simple Way. Workers worried that the dealer's presence would scare people in the neighborhood off from reporting violence and cause shootings to increase again. "Snitch culture is still really strong here," Miguel Diaz, who helps run the Simple Ways food bank, told me. "The state can't afford to move people or help them if they testify in shootings." Claiborne believes that race plays a larger role than religion in influencing white evangelicals' fondness for guns. According to a Pew study, 57% of white evangelical gun owners cite protection as the main reason that they carry firearms. They envision themselves defending their families against criminals, who are often rendered as black or brown inner-city men. According to Claiborne, many evangelicals imagine Jesus in their own image as a white, middle-class Republican who shares their interests and fears. They have bumper stickers that read, "Jesus would still be alive if he'd had an AR-15. In fact, gun violence proportionately affects people of color, and white Americans are largely insulated from its day-to-day toll, though this may be changing as school shootings affect suburban communities. That evening, we drove to Broad Street Ministry, a large Presbyterian church in downtown Philadelphia that serves 450 people lunch each day and houses hundreds more each night. When we arrived, paint was flaking from its walls, and the sexton was mopping vomit off the stoop. Claiborne and Martin were launching their book and holding a vigil for survivors of gun violence. When the event began, Movita Johnson Harrell, the first Muslim woman to serve as a state representative in Pennsylvania, told the story of losing her son Charles in 2011 to a shooter in northwestern Philadelphia who mistook him for someone else. "It is each individual's responsibility to be part of the solution and not the problem," she said. "There is no gray area." When Claiborne took the stand, he brandished what looked like a black leather Bible and then opened the cover to reveal a gun holster. "This is what people are using to carry their guns to church," he said. Hidden holsters were growing more popular, he told the crowd, as church shootings made Christians think that they needed to protect themselves while at prayer. Then he began listing gun violence statistics in a call and response with the audience. "In America, we make 9.5 million guns a year, 26,000 a day," he said. "Can I get a Lord have mercy?" "Lord have mercy," the crowd replied. 105 people die from guns every day and 38,000 a year. Lord have mercy." The next morning, before leaving on the trip, Claiborne and Martin kneeled on the sidewalk in Kensington next to their mobile forge among a pile of guns that they'd collected from neighbors or found in abandoned homes. Martin was sawing an AK-47 in half and preparing to turn it into a mattock, an old-fashioned hoe with prongs in one side, which is used for breaking up clods of earth. He had grown up in a conservative evangelical church in Colorado. "It was very much God, guns, and country," he said. But in college, he decided to return to his family's Mennonite roots, a tradition that emphasizes nonviolence. With the help of a metal worker in Colorado, he had taught himself the rudiments of blacksmithing. Martin picked up the barrel of the AK-47 with a pair of long steel tongs and placed it into the forge until it softened and glowed a molten red. Claiborne picked up a microphone. "Come on out, folks," he called to his neighbors. "If you're out here and you got guns, we'll chop them up." The crowd of 24 people who gathered came mostly from Circle of Hope, a network of Christians who do community work in the toughest neighborhoods in Philadelphia and support one another's weird progressive Christian activities, as one member in the crowd put it. Not all share the same opinions about politics or guns. "I see firearms as a useful tool," Mark Mumbauer, a 39-year-old Mennonite and hunter, told me. Once, while leading a discussion among his progressive friends about spiritual warfare, he brought a gun to use as visual aid, which caused alarm. "I realized it was a terrible idea," he told me. P.J. Rainey, a 19-year-old wearing a Balenciaga baseball cap and an eye patch, stood at the edge of the crowd. When Rainey was 13, she was shot in the eye with a stray bullet. "At first, I was afraid that no one would ever love me anymore," she told me. Jonathan Olszewski, a friend of Claiborne's, had spent the last 5 years filming a documentary about Rainey's family's recording studio, which they ran out of their basement so that local kids could record music. After the shooting, Olszewski kept filming and made the incident the focus of the project. The film Quest premiered at Sundance in 2017. Since then, Rainey has traveled around the country talking to people about guns. She hadn't been through formal counseling. She didn't trust paid professionals to empathize with what she'd gone through and preferred speaking with small church groups in cities or small towns affected by gun violence. "It's my therapy," she said. When she traveled the country, she was surprised at how backward some of the Midwestern towns seemed. "Their sneakers are always way behind," she told me. The mattock that Martin was making was going to be a gift for Rainey, which she would use in the small garden behind her house. She took a turn striking the molten metal with a hammer and, afterward, turning to address the crowd. She still didn't know who had shot her. Many young men in the neighborhood used her family studio, and she thought that some of them must know, but were too scared to tell her. She said that she had forgiven the shooter, but that she had some idea for how to hold people accountable in the future. What if each gun were fired before it was sold, and a photo of the bullet's signature was stored in a database? Then whoever bought and sold the weapon could be traced, she explained. Claiborne stood at the edge of the gathering in front of a sign that read, "Jesus was homeless," listening intently as Rainey spoke. He had called for a similar measure as part of the code that he'd proposed for the shooter shop before it closed. "Although it was never our goal to shut down the shop, it's nice that homeless veterans are now living there," he said. "I'm reluctant to attribute this to God, but it's kind of a swords to plowshares thing." And now, from the American Chronicles section, an essay entitled, "What's New About Conspiracy Theories?" Outsiders have always had a weakness for paranoid fantasies. Now our leaders are conspiracists, too. By Elizabeth Colbert. On the morning of December 4th, 2016, Edgar Madison Welch, a warehouse worker and a father of two from Salisbury, North Carolina, told his family that he had a few things to do. Loaded an AR-15, a .38 caliber revolver, and a folding knife into his car and headed for Washington, D.C. Welch's intention, he later told police, was to self-investigate a plot featuring, in no particular order, Hillary Clinton, sex trafficking, satanic rituals, and pizza. At around 3 p.m., Welch arrived at Comet Ping Pong, a restaurant in Chevy Chase, where he believed children were being held in a network of tunnels. He made his way to the kitchen, shot open a locked door, and discovered cooking utensils. In an interview from jail a few days later, he acknowledged to the Times, "The intel on this wasn't 100%. He'd found no captive children in the restaurant's basement. In fact, as many accounts of the incident noted, Comet Ping Pong doesn't even have a basement. Far from being dissuaded by the new intel, believers in what had become known as Pizzagate dug in. Welch had dabbled in acting. He'd appeared as a victim in a low-budget slasher movie. Thus, it followed, his raid on the restaurant had been staged. That the plotters had gone to such lengths to cover their tracks showed just how much evil there was to hide. "This runs very deep," a contributor to the subreddit thread r/conspiracy wrote. All the while, the restaurant's owner was receiving death threats. Some 10 months after the incident at Comet Ping Pong, a prediction surfaced on the web that Clinton would soon be arrested. "Expect massive riots organized in defiance," an anonymous poster, Q, warned on the message board 4chan. Other prophecies followed. Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, would also be arrested. Members of the media would be jailed as deep cover agents. There would be a Twitter blackout heralding a government purge. As Q's prophecies failed, more converts were won over. QAnon, as Q's worldview came to be known, subsumed, or if you prefer, consumed, Pizzagate, and then it too slunk off the web and into the world. Last June, an unemployed former Marine named Matthew Wright parked a home-built armored truck on the Mike O'Callaghan-Pat Tillman Memorial Bridge, which spans the Colorado River on the border of Arizona and Nevada. Wright, who, like Welch, was armed with an AR-15 and a handgun, blocked traffic for almost 90 minutes before surrendering to the police. At one point, he held up a sign that said, "Release the OIG report," a reference to another QAnon prediction involving the Justice Department's Office of the Inspector General. Following his arrest, Wright wrote a letter to the White House saying that he simply wanted the truth on behalf of all Americans, all of humanity, for that matter. America has always had a weakness for paranoid fantasies. According to some historians, the Founding Fathers were moved to write the Declaration of Independence by groundless fears of a British plot. Conspiracy Theories in American History, a two-volume encyclopedia, runs from abolitionism to ZOG. ZOG, an acronym used by survivalists, is shorthand for the Zionist Occupied Government, which the encyclopedia explains refers to an, quote, international Jewish conspiracy to undermine U.S. sovereignty and true Christianity. In between are some 300 entries, including black helicopters, contrails, Illuminati, moon landings, Pan Am 103, and Roswell. In this context, Pizzagate and QAnon could be considered madness as usual, just two late alphabet entries in the annals of national crankdom. But is that all there is to it? Or are deeper, darker forces at work? A confirmed conspiracist now occupies the White House, and no collusion notwithstanding, there's evidence that an international conspiracy put him in there. Coincidence? To paraphrase Q, perhaps it's time to expand our thinking. Russell Muirhead and Nancy L. Rosenblum are professors of government at respectively Dartmouth and Harvard. A few years ago, they found themselves, in their words, startled into thought. Yes, they knew crazy ideas were a fixture of American life, but not this crazy. The subject required more detailed and thoughtful interpretation, the two write at the beginning of A Lot of People Are Saying, the New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. Classic conspiracy theories, according to Muirhead and Rosenblum, arise in response to real events. The assassination of John F. Kennedy, say, or the terrorist attacks of September 11th. Such theories, they argue, constitute a form of explanation, however inaccurate they may be. What sets theories like QAnon apart is a lack of interest in explanation. Indeed, as with the non-existent child trafficking ring being run out of the non-existent basement, there is often nothing to explain. The professors observe the new conspiracism sometimes seems to arise out of thin air. The constituency, too, has shifted. Historically, Muirhead and Rosenblum maintain, it's been out-of-power groups that have been drawn to tales of secret plots. Today, it's those in power who insist that the game is rigged, and no one more insistently than the so-called leader of the free world. Donald Trump got his start in national politics as a birther, promoting the idea that President Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States. Several news organizations have tried to keep track of the conspiracy theories Trump has floated since then. One list, posted by the website Business Insider, has 19 entries. These include the claims that vaccines can cause autism and that the Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia may have been murdered. They're saying they found the pillow on his face, Trump said of Scalia during the 2016 campaign, which is a pretty unusual place to find a pillow. The Business Insider list is limited to full-blown conspiracy theories and excludes the president's more casual lies and fabrications. No president, indeed no national official, has resorted to accusations of conspiracy so instinctively, so frequently, and with such brio as Donald Trump, Muirhead and Rosenblum wrote. With Trump in power, they worry there's a danger that his dark fantasies may be realized. Democracies depend on buy-in. Citizens need to believe in certain basics, starting with the legitimacy of elections. Trump both runs the government and runs it down. The electoral system, he asserts, can't be trusted. Voter fraud is rampant. His contempt for institutions ranging from the courts, slow and political, to the Federal Communications Commission, so sad and unfair, to the FBI, what are they hiding, weakens those institutions, thereby justifying his contempt. As government agencies lose competence and capacity, they will come to look more and more illegitimate to more and more people, Muirhead and Rosenblum assert. Trump is so closely tied to the new conspiracism that it can be hard to tell the ranter from the rant. Then again, it's hard to imagine his ascent without other key developments. The polarization of the electorate, a generation of attacks, mostly from the right, on the news media and government, and, of course, the rise of the web. Spreading conspiracy theories once had a price. Printing or even mimeographing a tract cost money. But now, as Muirhead and Rosenblum point out, anyone can post a madcap theory or a doctored photograph virtually for free. The Internet revolution has displaced the gatekeepers, the producers, editors, and scholars who decided what was worthy of dissemination, they write. This has opened the way for conspiracy entrepreneurs who proffer a seemingly infinite array of wild accusations. Is it possible to make a rigorous study of conspiracy theories? The test seems self-punishing, like trying to housebreak a chicken. Nevertheless, this is the mission that Joseph E. Usinski and Joseph M. Parent have chosen to take on. Research into conspiracy theories has been hampered by a lack of long-term systematic data, Usinski and Parent, political scientists at the University of Miami and the University of Notre Dame, respectively write in American Conspiracy Theories. Fortunately, methods are now available to better scrutinize what we think we know. One of these methods is polling. Usinski and Parent commissioned a survey of more than 1,200 Americans, which asked them to react to statements like, quote, "much of our lives are being controlled by plots hatched in secret places," end quote. On the basis of their answers, respondents were sorted into three groups: high, those predisposed to conspiratorial thinking; low, those opposed to it; and medium, those in the middle. Then the researchers looked at the cross-tabulations. The less educated the respondent, the more likely he or she was to be a high. The poor tended to be more conspiratorially inclined than the rich. Roughly equal proportions of Democrats and Republicans were given to conspiracizing, but among respondents who identified with neither party, the proportion jumped. The conspiracy-minded Usinski and Parent conclude deserve their reputation as outsiders. They are less likely to vote and more apt to view bloodshed as a form of political protest. While 80% of the lows rejected the idea that, quote, "violence is sometimes an acceptable way to express disagreement with the government," end quote, among the highs, that figure dropped to 59%. It is disconcerting that, when asked about gun control, around half of those with higher conspiratorial predispositions wanted less strict gun laws, Usinski and Parent observe. For more long-term data, they turned to newspapers. A battery of assistants sifted through more than 100 years' worth of letters to the editor, published in the Times and in the Chicago Tribune. Letters that referred to any sort of group acting in secret at the expense of the common good were coded a, quote, "conspiracy talk." No effort was made to distinguish between talk about actual conspiracies, for example, Watergate, and baseless speculation. The groups denounced in such misses included the usual suspects: Catholics, communists, Jews, the United Nations, as well as more surprising targets: ice companies, Lutheran newspapers, the Senate printing office, and the Prime Minister of Malta. The schemes, too, ranged all over the diabolical map, from Herbert Hoover's secret business deals to bankrupt the U.S. to a CIA plot to spread lesbianism. When Usinski and Parent tallied the number of conspiracy-coded letters published each year, they found no 21st-century surge in paranoid thinking. On the contrary, averaging out the short-term ups and downs, they conclude that the amount of conspiracy talk has remained constant since the 1960s and has actually declined since the 1890s. We do not live in an age of conspiracy theories and have not for some time. That we believe we do makes sense, since that sentiment, too, is a constant. it's official. America is becoming a conspiratocracy, the Daily News announced in 2011. Are we living in a golden age of conspiracy theory? The Boston Globe wondered in 2004. It's the dawn of a new age of conspiracy theory, the Washington Post declared in 1994. Presumably, we can multiply examples back to Salem in 1692, but you understand the point. Uzinski and Parent write that conspiracy scares are ubiquitous. According to their analysis, short-term variations in the rate of conspiracy theorizing do not coincide with changing economic conditions or advances in technology like the web. Such is their take on scares that it's hard to imagine them finding anything new in the new conspiracism. Still, when it comes to paranoia in high places, they share some of Muirhead and Rosenblum's concerns. When there's an uptick in conspiracy theorizing by members of the elite, defined as government officials, entertainers, and journalists, they observe a corresponding uptick in paranoid theorizing more generally. This means you, Donald Trump, they write. In 2015, a young journalist named Anna Merlin took a cruise to Mexico. Most of the passengers on board the ship, the Ruby Princess, were ordinary vacationers, but a significant minority had signed on for a cruise within a cruise, dubbed by its organizers Conspiracy, spelled with a S-E-A at the end. The Conspiracy crowd was treated to lectures from various experts, including Andrew Wakefield, the British doctor whose bogus studies launched the anti-vax movement. When Merlin returned to shore, she wrote a lighthearted feature about the experience for the website Jezebel, in which she poked fun at the conspiracy-ers for having lost touch with reality. Then Trump was elected, and Edgar Welch showed up with his guns at Comet Ping Pong. Merlin decided that perhaps she was the one who was out of touch. In Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power, Merlin immerses herself in various subcultures of suspicion. She visits a gathering of white nationalists in eastern Kentucky, attends the annual meeting of the Mutual UFO Network, known as MUFON, and hangs out with the proponents of redemption theory, a strain of nuttiness based on the idea that every American is owed a cache of cash held secretly by the government. One of her first stops is a rally at a Pizzagate diehards in Lafayette Park, not far from the White House. This takes place in March 2017, 3 months after Welch's arrest. Merlin finds the crowd split into factions, each convinced that the other is made up of plants. She's interviewing a woman who wants to be known as Lala when she notices a man filming them with his phone. The man accuses Lala of belonging to the, quote, controlled opposition, end quote. He, in turn, is approached by other phone-wielding demonstrators and charged with working to undermine the cause. "You're protecting child molesters, bro," someone yells at him. But who's supposed to be doing the controlling or why is never quite clear. It seems that the core element from everyone inside this movement is distrust for everyone around them, Lala relates to Merlin. Nobody knows who's on whose side or what the truth is. Merlin encounters this dynamic frequently. People who believe conspiracy theories, it turns out, often suspect others who believe such theories of being crazy or worse. At the MUFON conference, just outside of Las Vegas, a speaker named Corey Good, an eminent figure in the world of ufology, describes how, as a kid, he was taken to an underground facility at Carswell Air Force Base in Texas and trained to fight aliens. Later, Good maintains, he roamed around the solar system doing surveillance and recon until finally his government handlers performed age regression, and sent him back home once again as a child. Another UFO researcher at the convention, Richard Dolan, tells Merlin he's worried about claims like Good's, which, quote, aren't particularly credible, end quote. Like the crowd in Lafayette Park, Dolan is concerned about plants, who he fears are out to undermine the whole ufology enterprise. History, he observes, is replete with provocateurs and disinformation coming from U.S. government channels. Americans, as Merlin notes, have long suspected the government of suppressing the truth about extraterrestrials. Such suspicions probably predate the term extraterrestrial. Other conspiracy theories, she observes, have even deeper roots. The charge of ritual child abuse, key to Pizzagate, was leveled against the Jews back in the Middle Ages. It has surfaced many times since, including during what's become known as the Satanic Panic, a rash of allegations that sent more than 20 Californians to prison in the 1980s. Virtually all the convictions have been overturned. Conspiracism, Merlin concludes, has more or less always been with us. Pizza parlor workers have simply replaced daycare workers who replaced Jews. But she also makes the opposite point. Like Muirhead and Rosenblum, Merlin believes that something novel and dangerous is going on right now. In her account, Trump gets a lot of the credit, or if you prefer, the blame, and so too does the Internet. Merlin cites the Columbine shooting, which took place in 1999, before the age of YouTube, easily buildable blogs, and widely used social media platforms. After the shooting, no one came forward to propose that Columbine had been staged. Today, it is pretty much guaranteed that a mass shooting will give rise to a community on the web that insists the victims are crisis actors. Merlin interviews Lenny Posner, a former IT consultant whose six-year-old son, Noah, died in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in 2012. Posner has spent most of the past 6 years battling conspiracists who insist that the shooting never happened and that Noah never even existed. In February, a Connecticut judge ordered Alex Jones, the owner of the website InfoWars and a leading purveyor of the Sandy Hook as hoax theory, to sit for a deposition in a lawsuit brought by the parents of slain children. In the deposition in March, Jones claimed that a form of psychosis had made him believe the massacre was staged. This category of recent conspiracy theorists is really a global network of village idiots, Posner tells Merlin. They would have never been able to find each other before, but now it's a synergistic effect of the combination of all of them all over the world. There are haters from Australia and Europe, and they could all make a YouTube video in 15 seconds. During the 2016 presidential election, Zeynep Tufekci was watching tapes of Trump rallies when she noticed something odd. Tufekci, an associate at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society and a self-described techno-socialist, found that YouTube began queuing up for her videos filled with racist diatribes and Holocaust denials. She wondered what was going on, so she created another account and began watching clips of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. This time, she found herself directed to what she later described in the Times as videos of a leftist conspiratorial cast, including some that argued that the U.S. government was responsible for the attacks of September 11th. Tufekci concluded that YouTube had decided that the best way to hold viewers' attention was to push them toward more and more sensational material. The motive wasn't political, it was commercial, and probably the scheme wasn't the work of a cabal or even a person, but of an algorithm. What we are witnessing is the computational exploitation of a natural human desire to look behind the curtain, Tufekci wrote. At a minimum, what's new about the new conspiracism is the number of people exposed to it. If there's a natural human desire to get at some hidden truth, it's never been easier to indulge that desire or to imagine doing so via YouTube or InfoWars or Twitter. It's unclear how many of those who are led to post on the truth about 9/11 or listen to Alex Jones or follow Trump's tweets actually believe what they encounter, but only a tiny fraction can create a very big problem. After all, almost 2 billion people click on YouTube videos every month. In a tacit acknowledgement of responsibility, Pinterest blocked vaccine-related searches on its site after measles outbreaks in several states this winter. Facebook, too, recently said that it would reduce the ranking of groups or pages that spread misinformation about vaccinations. In January, without ever explaining how its Up Next algorithm works, YouTube announced that it would begin reducing recommendations of borderline content, including videos making blatantly false claims about historic events like 9/11. Meanwhile, Pizzagate stumbles on. A couple of months ago, another man was arrested in connection with Comet Ping Pong, this one for setting fire to the place. And now, A History of the Influencer, From Shakespeare to Instagram, by Lawrence Scott. Late last year, the Daily Mail identified Ralphie Waplinken as Britain's youngest social media influencer. Ralphie, who is two, has 20,000 Instagram followers. For most of his life, he has been an unknowing model of baby clothes and other infant paraphernalia. His parents photograph him according to briefs they receive from commercial partners. Members of his extended family must seek approval before posting their own photos of Ralphie, lest an off-message picture harm his brand. Oh, Ralphie is undeniably cute, but his cuteness only compounds the sense of unease we feel whenever we contemplate influencers and their craft. On one level, influencer is an anodyne commercial label describing someone who monetizes an online following by endorsing products or services, a celebrity spokesperson for the social media age. And yet, influencer also sounds slightly sinister. The influencer could be a Batman villain, alongside the Joker. It's no accident that the term has entered the lexicon at the same moment that influence of a different sort has become a geopolitical weapon of unprecedented proportions. The social media influencer has an eerie double in the hacker who covertly shapes political discourse. Both flourish in our increasingly networked world, in which digital influence is sharply double-edged, a saleable commodity and a threat to democracy, a commercial dream and a political nightmare. Connectivity is the basis for the heightened role that influence now plays in our lives. Digital technologies soften the borders between people and create a porousness upon which influence depends. In a fairly undisguised etymology, the word influence comes from the Latin for in flow, which provides an image of the way that every second our thoughts now stream into one another's pockets. The same image evokes our anxieties about hostile foreign states penetrating our defenses. Influence is a challenge to sovereignty, both political and personal. To admit to being influenced is to give up the attractive idea that, as individuals or societies, we are entirely self-contained. The elusive quality of influence, the difficulty we encounter when we try to identify its sources or measure its effects, is equally destabilizing. Influence works best when it's wielded obscurely in the shadows and behind the scenes, and this has clear social consequences for a society engaged in building a digital influence economy. Based on the available evidence, it seems that we can't construct an influence economy without stoking a culture of skepticism and paranoia. The fear of being influenced affects our senses of reality and our ability to trust our own judgments about what is true. Election hackers and commercial influencers have wildly different aims, but both contribute to the unreal, distrustful tenor of our times, in which a language of fakery, deception, and inauthenticity has become fundamental to how we interpret the world. Influence was worrisome long before it was digital. The word influence appears in a quarter of William Shakespeare's plays, in which the condition of being influenced is rarely happy or dignified. Almost without exception, Shakespeare gives influence a darkly astrological cast. In Measure for Measure, Vincentio argues that it's misguided to fear death, since human life is so inescapably servile to all the skyey influences that hourly afflict this earth. Influential mortals, meanwhile, often mock those who are susceptible to influence. Perrault's The Vulgar Unreliable Soldier in All's Well That Ends Well encourages the young Count Bertram to exploit his position in the court, which is populated, Perrault says, by those who eat, speak, and move under the influence of the most received star. Today, as we know, the word star still describes someone who possesses extraordinary influence. Shakespeare's portrayal of influence may seem outmoded, but it has an unsettling echo in the fact that, in many ways, online influence isn't directed by human agents. The algorithms that dictate which videos are recommended by YouTube or the hidden engines that prioritize certain social media posts over others are the digital equivalents of Shakespeare's remote skyey influences. Their agendas are unknowable and changeable. Even social media influences are subject to the whims of the algorithms, as if they were serving capricious deities. In 2017, the Federal Trade Commission released guidelines calling for social media influencers to become more transparent about their corporate relationship. Avoid ambiguous disclosures like hashtag thanks, hashtag club, hashtag SP, hashtag spawn, or hashtag ambassador, the commission suggested. Clarity counts. Unfortunately, clarity is at cross purposes with influence, which is powerful precisely because it's ambiguous. In both the political and commercial spheres, this ambiguity has an unsettling effect. We begin asking ourselves questions such as, was that the story I glimpsed in my newsfeed from a credible source? Was that product recommendation written by a genuine consumer or a paid spokesperson? Why do I want what I want? Why do I hold the political beliefs I do? These unknowables, in turn, prompt an even more vexing question. What does it even mean to have an unadulterated and authentic opinion? The knowledge that influence is such a major animator of public life increases our cynicism about others and about ourselves. The idea of influence has come to feel more solid for the rest of us as well. Scrolling through our feeds, we are certain that powerful people and corporations are trying to influence us. In response, we may be tempted to nurture a ferocious independence, a sensibility unswayed by external agendas. The trouble, though, is that resisting the influence of others so wholeheartedly can amount to a kind of totalitarianism of the spirit, a walling in of the self. In Shakespeare, it's the unpleasant characters such as Paroles who make fun of other people's impressionability. In King Lear, the illegitimate son Edmund says that blaming bad behavior on planetary influence is foppery. He maintains that his own nature is inevitable and self-actualizing. I should have been that I am, he says, and had the maideniest star in the firmament twinkled on my bastardizing. There is a vanity in this view of isolated self-determination, an intransigence that is a hallmark of our polarized political climate. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long, everybody.